interrupted a current neo-rodeo. Climate challenge, behaviorally controlled, energy-starved, alien-invaded, nuclear-glowing, postulated cricketism to bring you behind the woodshed. This is Cricketude-Busting Episode BTWRLM 621. And remember, being free is not a spectator sport, so get you behind the woodshed, because you don't know what you missed until you make the switch and get you behind the woodshed. For that dose of reality, because you can't go wrong when you get behind the woodshed. One of those things we must be free from is going with the flow when it's going in the wrong direction. This widespread misuse of the term domestic terrorism, it's a normalization, as I've been listening for it, seeing it, hearing it used, and just kind of getting out of hand. I want to kind of address something right up front with it, so that, again, we go looking instead of just throwing out our opinions, go find out what the facts are. Don't build in a propaganda term that they're going to eventually use against us. I found a thread of a post set on X Twitter from one starting at Jerry Callahan, who posted on X Twitter, Jim keyed a Cybertruck in New Hampshire over the weekend. I wonder if he thinks it was worth it. And Cat Turd replied, this is domestic terrorism and should be treated as such. A minimum of 5 years in prison. And I asked through a repost of Proudover, how is keying a truck domestic terrorism? Proudover replied to me, agree 100%, but this is, and he includes a link to a YouTube of a report of a multiple Tesla cars in Vegas being damaged and set on fire. To which I reply, thanks, but it's not the number of cars. The elements of the crime have to fit this definition, and I post the Cornell website page for Title 182331, and I continue on saying, and no one is explaining how these criminal acts do that. And I'm asking because I don't think we the people want to drop the requirements as it suits the suits. And then James Jensen sent me a reply with an article from John Rutherford, which I read, and I'll read for you in a moment. And I sent back to James a reply that says, I must be in good company. You've heard me address these same things behind the woodshed, in particular due process and habeas. Why I'm keen to hear an answer to the use of domestic terrorism, as I just asked Proudover and others before, same threat is now. James replies to me that he found that keying the vehicle does not meet the definition in the statute, the domestic terrorism definition of that in the statute. But he did find that it would be malicious mischief is more fitting a description. And I responded to that and I said, and that's what the keying was charged out as, not domestic terrorism, in a report and story I had just heard not later that evening, the title of which is, Ensler was smacked with charges of malicious mischief in the third degree. And I'll provide a link for that. I told James, good call. So he went down and found it. As I ask you all do, just go track it down, find out what it would be, and start learning what really is going on to essentially separate the fiction from the fact and keep your eye on the ball, essentially. Because I have a feeling that, and it's a little bit more than a feeling, not nothing more than a feeling, but a feeling that this is a setup. And we're watching a bunch of people, a lot of cheerleaders bring this along, this term domestic terrorism. You've heard me talk about it. You've heard about being involved with the FBI, the post office, trying to make a complaint, and they turn you around, and they turn the thing on you, and they tell you that, in so many words, you're a domestic terrorist just for asking a question. So I've got my experience in this years and years ago, that the bar was going to be lowered, and here we are. Now everyone's talking about, in this one story, keying a Tesla, keying a car, taking a key and running it across the paint job, is all of a sudden now domestic terrorism. And so I provide a link to the Tesla keying story, including the charges, that are way, way short of domestic terrorism, when they were charged by the local jurisdiction. So remember this as well. The feds have a definition of domestic terrorism, but the local jurisdiction has their laws as well, the states, let's just say. And the title of that was The Karen who has seen keying a Tesla in Washington state has been identified as 55-year-old millionaire Camilla Ensler. So let's just give you a reference. Let me read the law now, what I'm talking about. Again, it's not an opinion here. It's not cheerleading. It's not going with the flow of what someone is saying is good to make America great again. When you look at what they're doing, they're diminishing ever so greatly what's really supposed to be happening. And this has been my criticism of this the entire time. We didn't need to go this way, but look at where they're taking it. So the basis for the elements of what the United States defines domestic terrorism to be is found at 18 U.S.C. 2331 definitions. And I'll just go down. We're only going to talk about the one little part just to give you a basis again to start balancing what you're hearing, the facts of what's going on out there, and apply them to this definition. And when you start hearing someone using the term domestic terrorism and you can't apply this definition, then you know this is a big propaganda, this is a psyop, this is they're trying to normalize the definition so it's applied to the smallest amount of crime, if you will, that can be found. So number five here we'll read. You go down to number five at 18 U.S.C. 2331, and I just have given you a link to the Cornell Law website. Number five says, the term domestic terrorism means activities that, A, involve acts dangerous to human life that are a violation of the criminal laws of the United States or of any state. B, appear to be intended, to intimidate or coerce a civilian population. II, to influence the policy of government by intimidation or coercion. Or, III, to affect the conduct of a government by mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping. And C, occur primarily within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States. And it goes on to number 6, which is a different definition. So in that sense, when you read through that, if you loosely apply the first one, I guess it's committing arson is dangerous to the public. But when you listen to what terrorism is about, keying a car or committing arson, damaging a car, is not the type of dangerous to human life they're talking about here. We're talking a bigger type of crime. But the act would be a crime underneath the laws. We also point out the territorial jurisdiction. There's a lot of discussion about that, depending on the intent. And I pointed out to you the territorial jurisdiction of the United States is not your state's, even though there's a lot of judicial determinations that might say so. Again, going back to Julian Assange, why even talk about this stuff? It's referenced all over the place. They went to an island way out in the Pacific as a territorial jurisdiction of the United States, remember. They didn't come to the mainland. So understand this little interesting question there. Where is the territorial jurisdiction? It doesn't say continental jurisdiction. So let's go back to just kept that mind, that list in your mind, and we wouldn't find that going against a company, one company and its products would fulfill a population attack, and nothing listed in the things that I just talked to you apply to arson or keying, or in particular to Tesla property destruction. I'm not certainly not saying it's good. I'm saying that we're looking at a government that wants to apply domestic terrorism to keying a car. We should be very, very critical of that and actually get real uppity about it a bit and start telling these folks that that's not plausible. So I'm not sure why Trump's people keep parroting domestic terrorism. The Attorney General of the United States just said, we're going to charge those out as domestic terrorist charges. And I just read them to you what domestic terrorism is. It's a definition. It's already in law. It's supposed to be abided by the officials. Why would the Attorney General of the United States say such a dumb thing? Because I think it's an op. They want people to cheerlead that this was domestic terrorism, just like Cat Turd did. And I guess there's a couple of couple of episodes now, I've been talking about him in particular. I don't even know the gentleman. I don't really follow them. It just seems to pop up in my feed. Like, it's a psyop. They want to tell me what his opinion is. And I'll look at everybody's opinion. I'll listen to it. I'll look around. People ask me questions, and I go do some real quick research if I don't know. And a lot of times, it's not what I'm being fed in my feed from ex-Twitter. Because you are the media, remember? If you can put all that together, I hope you do, real quick, you start seeing how we're being led by the nose until they will have their way with us. Our minds are being programmed as we see this. So, getting back to what, parroting domestic terrorism, that's what I've heard the FBI does. When you start looking at that list and what they're doing, when you look at all the stories, and them getting Trump's credit to call it out, what they did, lawfare and all that, when you look and you apply that list to that I just read in this definition to what the FBI does, what the government does, what the legislature does, you'll see they are the domestic terrorists. And I encourage you to read those and think about that. You don't have to come to my conclusions. Find out your conclusions, but at least have a basis for those conclusions. So why are people who claim to be American first so mind-controlled that they repeat the fraudulent claim that simple crimes is domestic terrorism and call for its imposition when what they are calling for is that the government will treat most any crime to be considered terrorism? Now, how stupid and anti-American, that's S-T-O-O-P-I-D for your hearing sensitive listener. How have you become to insist sounds no different here to me than wokeness on steroids? How screwed up, that's S-C-R-O-O-D for the hearing sensitive. How screwed up are we as a society when we start to do this so readily and so quickly? Actually, that's the most astonishing part to me, how quickly people adopt this. Let me go back to the 5 years. 5 years doesn't mean nothing to me. All you got to do is go to the code. The code will tell you what the penalty is going to be. Why do they do it that way? That's notice. That's the notice they put in the law that says this is how you're going to comport your activities. And this is a definition for when you know you're going to be committing domestic terrorism. Is not keying a car, is not setting a car on fire. As bad as that is, multiple Teslas, as bad as that is, that it doesn't rise to the definition that we need. And yet the Attorney General of the United States is saying, well, we're going to charge this out as domestic terrorism. And everybody's going, yeah, right, give them 5 years. Nobody goes to the law to see if that's actually the charge, the amount of years they're supposed to get either. So where do we go as a society? It doesn't sound really too good. And we're going to see the same people promoting, agreeing to, and agreeing with Trump to impose voter ID on people. Now, I'm pausing a bit here because I think just no one's really... I've been talking about this. I've been pointing out to what's going on. No different than someone says someone get 5 years for keying a car because it's domestic terror. Obviously, it's domestic terrorism. But someone says an objection comes, well, this doesn't look like terrorism, and someone comes back, I agree with you 100%, but this is, and instead of being keying a car, it's setting a car on fire. There's a bunch of nonsense in people's minds about what's going on. It allows people to be influenced to go demand things that are not, that they do not understand. Literally do not understand the consequences and steps. And when I got just jumped over to voter ID, why? It's because that's in the news. It's where it's been going. It's what the government's been trying to get you to get done. And I've told you the danger of all that, in particular, what you're having to say you are as a status in order to have that happen. And we already found out Trump don't care about the law in numerous places. So now we just talk, efficiency. The ends justify the means. No, they don't. Not in this case. This means your rights here, folks. This means statuses that take rights. Remember, you have to be a federal resident in order to get a voter ID. But you do it through your state, so they're complicit in this crime. And they've taken away your rights to travel, not the right to travel as you understand it, your right to use the highway, your ingress and egress rights. And they've traded them, they've allowed them to trade them for a commercial privilege. I'm talking all about this. And that's what the voter ID becomes in order to get people, oh, we got our voting, our rights are wrong. We have a wrong guy in the office that should have won 4 years, 8 years ago. Oh, well, this and all that. And voting with the voter ID is going to solve it. You don't even know what they're doing to you. It's fascinating to watch just, oh, yeah, that's going to solve it. You don't realize the what the jurisdiction is the government's talking about. The voter ID, and then no one pays attention. It's separate from state. And then the judiciary gets to step in with all this confusion, and they tell you what it is, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it is what it is. And then we get all these situations like down in Arizona where, well, state people have to show an ID where federalities, the people that are federal, don't. And no one can understand it. So I'm trying to point out here, we get these terms, what we think needs to be done, and we don't look behind the curtain, if you will, of the status that's being created in order to do that, or the diminishment of our rights that's going on. Why I talked about to Khalil. You want to diminish someone you think because you think that their skin color is too brown, or you think that they're foreigners, even though they went through a process, not much different than your driver's license to get, let's say, voter ID or your voter registration that then used the real ID. Went through no less a process, and they were issued something. And yet, if you were issued your license and they tried to take it away without due process, you'd be screaming. It's the same problem I'm trying to point out here on this subject matter of domestic terrorism, which has a much greater impact on us, and this comes from the 9/11 beginnings, where everyone was presumed to be a misdemeanor. Your presumption of innocence went out right out the window. And that's what you're also doing here, because this country was about your word meant something, and the truth of your word meant something as a presumption. Now they allowed the country to be flooded by illegal immigrants, and everyone forgets that those people still have rights, even if they got here a little bit unorthodox. They still have at least two statements they get to make. That should be in a hearing. If they can't comport, then they get back out. But to toss them back out after we've opened the gates, that's a wrong too. To have someone not understand the status that they've created in themselves by agreeing to that kind of a convolution is the problem with this country right now. It's what I try and show people all the time. I'm talking about almost all the time. So there's your definition of domestic terrorism. I hope when you go read it, you'll see too, as I just discussed it here, and quickly, even if you quickly picked up on it, the elements of the definition of domestic terrorism do not fit keying a car, do not fit arson, however big in particular one. It may not even fit however large a space, like lighting a fire on a forest, because it has the other two elements. And the main one is that you're attempting to change government through your actions, whether it's by the people changing their vote, changing how they view the government, or how the government itself needs, like you've heard, make policy regarding it. Keying a Tesla doesn't do any of those things. And there's a whole lot more to that section. I won't go deeper in it. But I want people to start becoming aware that we, for all the good we could have thought that Trump and his administration could do, I told you he's a double-edged sword. He's looking more, not the Messiah, he's looking more like that false prophet. He's looking like the anti-hero, and he can have a good side and a bad side. So you must be very careful on what he's doing. His agenda now seems to be to get the word out and let people support and cheerlead for this, that we're going to lower the definition of domestic terror. We won't care about it. It's just we're going to say this is what we're going to charge out. And now setting a car on fire is going to be that. Keying a car is going to be that. Some of you have done code enforcement ideas and thoughts and what's going on internationally. And the fact I told you to take away your property and then you don't have any due process rights. You start watching what this is doing. You lower the bar too low. It doesn't matter what you do. You're a domestic terrorist and they can deal with you as they want. You're watching Trump. Even though he's getting caught after the fact, you're watching Trump do that right now. He decides, it's done. Muskrat decides, it's done. Rubio decides, it's over. Is not making America great again, I guess I'll say it that way. So now I'll read John Whitehead's article about taking legal immigrant citizens' rights, as I similarly explained last episode. the danger to everyone, not just these immigrants of various statuses being summarily deported, and how most everyone believes Trump is correct to expand domestic terrorism for mere arson or consider further, in this case, John Whitehead, poses that expansion to domestic terrorism as a potential in this article, where I'm suggesting it's already occurring if we don't constrain the term domestic terrorism as it's limited in the U.S. code right now. So John Whitehead's article is entitled Making Our Rights Disappear, the Authoritarian War on Due Process. Is that war declared by Congress? His article goes on, if Trump can disappear them, he can disappear you. Again, I'll interject. Listen how closely now we're talking, John Whitehead and myself, of what I've said over many episodes here relative to this very subject matter that he puts in a nice, concise article for us to pick up the points and to consider very deeply. Again, this is not about illegal immigrants. This is about a way to use those at the stalking horses to come and take our rights. As the title did here, Making Our Rights Disappear. And we're going to be cheerleading for that, is what I'm starting to see. And I don't want to criticize people. These are people, what they believe and how they respond to those beliefs and those feelings, nothing more than feelings. I've been warning against this for a long time that we can't do that. Shamefully, we should be able to do anything we would like to, but we do that and we get induced into false directions, and it's very dangerous to us. If Trump can disappear them, he can disappear you. Trump regime is already targeting immigrants who are here legally simply because they expressed opinions that Trump disagreed with. What makes you think that he'll stop there, with no court to verify anything the Trump regime alleges you could be arrested and sent to a prison in El Salvador for having news of views that the regime dislikes, as stated by Robert Reich? Imagine this. You're rounded up in the dead of night by government agents, arrested and sent to a detention center. The arresting agencies don't identify themselves, nor do they provide any documentation indicating why you are being detained. Nevertheless, without your family or friends knowing that you have been taken hostage, without anyone knowing where you are being transported or why, and without any opportunity to defend yourself or proclaim your innocence, you are flown out of the country to a foreign prison in a police state where you will have no rights whatsoever. Let me interject. I don't know if I want to interject too much. Remember, we already talked about Interpol being able to come in this country when they wrote the murder memo and extrajurisdictional extradition. This has all been in the works. It's already in the body of this country. It's already in the rules and the laws. It's already in the agreements. That right there. As I'm reading that, what I got picked up relative to my documentary for the child services documentary that I was doing and got picked up one night, that's pretty much, except I didn't leave the country, that's pretty much what happened to me. Nobody knew what happened to me. I was disappeared for quite a long time. So I've already experienced this. So a little half of it. I didn't get put into El Salvador. This country has been doing this to people at the state level, the county level, for all the time after 9/11. And then we heard of what they did with extrajudicial extradition and that they would use foreign authorities to do so. Okay, so this is just, he doesn't mention all this here. I want to remind you that this is already in place, but here we're watching Trump, of all people, make America great again. Trump is pulling this right in front of everybody. And most people that I've been watching agree with it. It's really a shocking thing to my mind. Anyway, read back to the article here. There can be no understating the danger. The war on due process is here. No trials, no hearings, no rights, just indefinite detention and secret deportations. This is the fate that awaits every one of us, not just immigrants, legal or otherwise, if the government's war on the Constitution remains unchecked. A historian, Timothy Snyder, warns, quote, if you accept that non-citizens have no right to due process, you are accepting that citizens have no right to due process. All governments have to do is claim that you are not a citizen without due process, you have no chance to prove to the contrary. More than two decades after the United States government and its post-9/11 frenzy transported individuals, some of whom had not been charged, let alone convicted of a crime, to CIA black sites, quote, parenthetically, secret detention centers located outside the United States authorized to torture detainees, as a means of sidestepping legal protocols, the Trump administration is using extraordinary rendition to make those on its so-called, quote, enemies list disappear. The first round of arrests and deportations to a mega prison in El Salvador supposedly targeted members of the infamous Venezuela gang Tren de Aragua. Quote, Nazis got better treatment under the Alien Enemies Act than what has happened here, declared U.S. Circuit Judge Patricia Millett. Y'all could have put me up on Saturday and thrown me on a plane thinking I'm a member of Tren de Aragua and given me no chance to protest it and say somehow it's a violation of presidential war powers. Carried out with little evidence and without court hearings or due process, these roundups reportedly may also have swept up individuals with no apparent connection to gang activity apart from the common tattoos, parenthetically firearms, trains, dice, roses, tigers, jaguars, and other circumstantial evidence. In a particular Kafkaesque explanation of why some of the Venezuelan migrants who have no criminal records were targeted for arrest and deportation, government lawyers argued in court that their lack of criminal record is in itself cause for concern. In other words, the government was prepared to preemptively arrest and make people disappear without any regard for legal protocols or due process based on the president's claim that they could at some point in the future pose a threat to national security. This takes pre-crime and preemptive arrest to a whole new sinister level of potential abuses. Are you starting to sense how quickly this could go off the rails? This is how democracies collapse. This is how rights disappear overnight. As lawyers challenging the government's overreach warned, quote, if the president can designate any group as enemy aliens under the act, and that designation is unreviewable, then there is no limit on who can be sent to a Salvadorian prison, or any limit on how long they will remain there. At present, the Salvadoran president is saying that these men will be there at least a year, and then this imprisonment is renewable. Also among those in danger of being made to disappear without legal record or due process are individuals who have not been charged with or convicted of any crimes. The most egregious of these incidents involve college students, scientists, and doctors, all of them legal permanent residents of the United States who, while never having been charged with a crime, are accused of threatening national security by taking part in anti-war protests over the growing death toll in Gaza as a result of the Israeli-Hamas war, or sympathizing with the Palestinians, or being associated with someone who might sympathize with the Palestinians. I need to interject here. By sympathizing with Semitic people, and then going a little step further and saying the government needs to stop genocide, they are also fulfilling international law, which Trump is against here. So understand this part. And I guess I can say I'm probably insulting a whole lot of Trump people, but, you know, in a way, that's lawlessness that you're agreeing with. So I'm not too bashful to keep saying this. The article goes on to say, when merely exercising one's right to criticize the government in word, deed, or thought is equated to an act of domestic terrorism, we are all in trouble. Whether those being rounded up and deported have done anything criminally wrong is not the point. That's what the courts of the Constitution are for, to ensure that justice is served through due process and the right of the accused to have their day in court. It's not always a perfect system, but it's better than the alternative, which is outright tyranny. The mass arrests and roundups thus far have been so haphazard that there is a very real likelihood that innocent individuals have also been swept up and deported. American citizens could very well be next in line for this kind of treatment. Native Americans, who are also American citizens, have reported being subjected to racial profiling by ICE agents and targeted because of their race or skin color. Another American citizen detained and questioned by ICE during an immigration raid of a workplace in New Jersey is a military veteran who, quote, suffered the indignity of having to legitimacy of his military documentation question. A Foreign Policy magazine, as Foreign Policy magazine warns, quote, the American people must be clear-eyed about the prison system to which their government is sending deported migrants, which, in the worst-case scenario, could one day hold U.S. citizens, too. Although U.S. law prohibits the deportation of U.S. citizens, the Trump administration has shown a repeated proclivity to flout the rules and ignore judicial orders. Indeed, it appears that President Trump is borrowing heavily from the lockdown script used by Nayib Bukele, president of El Salvador, another police state characterized by arbitrary detention, systemic violations, brutality, and censorship, which have been under a permanent state of emergency since 2022. Yet, as Amnesty International warns, quote, security at the expense of human rights, increased militarization and armed repression, coupled with, quote, efforts to state by state agents to stigmatize human rights organizations and the free press and to thwart their efforts, has fostered a climate of fear and intimidation that stifles civil society and spurs self-censorship. Under Bukele, who used a war on gang violence as the pretext for seizing power, constitutional rights have been suspended, with attorneys general fired, judges replaced by loyalists, and legislative or judicial branches coalesced under one party, presidential term limits set aside, innocent individuals swept up in mass arrests, Bitcoin declared legal currency, and friendly overtures made to Russia and China. Sounds unnervingly familiar, doesn't it? This is a danger of allowing any president to use expansive wartime powers to bypass the Constitution's prohibitions against the government overreach and abuse. Suddenly, everything that challenges the government's authority becomes a national security threat, and every dispute a national emergency. And I'm going to interject one more time. We play a little file before the broadcast on Sunday for this broadcast. And I'm not sure if it's on the replays, but for Judge Napolitano, and I keep reading every paragraph I'm reading here, that file keeps running in my mind of what Judge Napolitano said and says about what could happen if, and it's in line with what Ron Paul did, what if he did relative to back in the 2010 time. And so this is not unknown, but this is right, even though it's not unknown, it's right here at our doorstep today. So much so that I'm even compelled to start talking about it, and based on some other direction that I'm noticing that allows societies to fall prey to this sort of expansion of power and tyranny. Through his use of executive orders, proclamations, and so-called national emergencies, President Trump has essentially declared war on the rule of law. Make no mistake, while immigrants, illegal and legal alike, have largely been the first victims of Trump's administration's efforts to circumvent the Constitution in order to make them disappear, it's our very freedoms that are being made to disappear. At the heart of these freedoms is the right of habeas corpus, translated as, quote, you should have the body. Habeas corpus is a legal action which those imprisoned unlawfully can seek relief from their imprisonment. Derived from English common law, habeas corpus first appeared in Magna Carta in 1215 as the oldest human right in the history of the English-speaking civilization. The doctrine of habeas corpus stems from the requirement that a government must either charge a person or let him go free. Without habeas corpus, other rights become vulnerable to executive overreach. The framers of the Constitution, having experienced firsthand what it was like to be labeled enemy combatants, imprisoned indefinitely, and not given the opportunity to appear before an impartial judge, were acutely aware of the potential for government tyranny. Thus, They enshrined the writ in Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution rather than the Bill of Rights, underscoring its fundamental importance as a safeguard against arbitrary detention and ensuring this protection at the federal level. It has all been downhill since then. History has shown us the dangers of unchecked executive power. Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus during the Civil War led to mass arrests without trial, setting a dangerous precedent. Decades later, the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II demonstrated how easily fear can be weaponized to justify the imprisonment of innocent people. Each time habeas corpus has been weakened, it has taken years, sometimes generations, for justice to be restored, if ever. We cannot afford to repeat these mistakes. While the Constitution allows the writ of habeas corpus to be suspended in cases of rebellion or invasion when public safety is imperiled, the Trump administration's efforts to keep the nation in a permanent state of emergency in order to justify its power grabs leaves we, the people, subject to the kinds of arbitrary mass roundups, arrests, and deportations that have been favored by despots and dictators. This is usually where the self-righteous defenders of Trump blatantly unconstitutionally tactics insist that the protection of the United States only apply to U.S. citizens. They are wrong. At a minimum, the United States Supreme Court has affirmed rights enshrined in the first 10 amendments to the Constitution apply to all people in the United States, regardless of their citizenship or immigration status. Those rights include free speech, peaceful protest, and criticisms of the government, assembly, religious freedom, and equal protection under the law, due process, legal representation, privacy, among others. Then again, what good are rights if the government doesn't respect them? What good are rights if the president is empowered to nullify them whenever he wants? For that matter, what is good is a government that betrays its own citizens? Can you hear the echo of Judge Napolitano here? Isn't that cool? When not even citizenship is protection against the abuses of an authoritarian regime, it's time to do what our forefathers did when they finally got fed up with being silenced, censored, searched, frisked, threatened, and arrested, revolt against the tyrant's fetters. History has shown us that when the government operates without checks and balances, tyranny follows. The question is not whether mass arrests and indefinite detentions could be expanded to American citizens. It's how long before they are. If we allow these erosions of due process, if we accept that a president can unilaterally decide who is a threat without oversight, then we have already lost freedoms that define us as a nation. This is not just about immigrants. It's about every American who values liberty over unchecked power. We must demand accountability. We must challenge policies that violate constitutional protections. We must support organizations fighting for civil liberties, educate ourselves on our rights, and refuse to be silenced by fear. Because when the government starts making people disappear, the only way to stop it is by making our voices impossible to ignore. Then he goes on to promote his book, Battlefield America, The War on American People, and a fictional counterpart of Eric Blair Diaries. Freedoms does not die in a single act of repression. It dies when people surrender their rights in exchange for false security. To interject right here, when you fill out these applications and you get privileges, like going through the Real ID Act to prove that you're a legitimate voter, look at the statuses underneath that. You give up, you surrender just gobs and gobs of things just to do that. People don't recognize that at all. History will judge how we respond. We must act before it's too late. The Constitution can't protect us if we don't protect it. And that is just invoking it. Time to resist is now. Otherwise, we don't stand up for freedom while we still can. We may not get another chance. And there's not much in this report that he has that I haven't said myself. I don't know what else more that needs to be said. It's a continuous theme behind Woodshed. I always take special note and educate yourself on what there is to do. You know I talk about habeas a ton. you'd know I tried to help assert it for the great Comey swindle. It was still regarding Trump, if you notice. So the writing's on the wall about what government does. I don't care who's running at it. And within all of this, within the domestic terrorism building, and them, the government wanting to make it bigger and bigger so that there's more and more for the government to come after, FBI scales back staffing tracking of domestic terrorism probes, sources say. The FBI has cut staffing in an office focused on domestic terrorism and has scrapped a tool used to track such investigations in a shift that could undermine law enforcement ability to counter white supremacists and anti-government extremists, according to sources familiar with the matter. Or it is because just as the CDC tagged the flu and the common cold as COVID, the only domestic terrorism being done was that of the FBI setting up dupes that called terrorism for public consumption and the ongoing cognitive warfare against us all, which is not FBI, but the U.S. military during the great Comey swindle, if we haven't seen all that. Everything else we can look back at the military, but no one wants to notice that. The great Comey swindle, we now have the proof, was absolutely military. And they're not called a domestic terrorist? You look at what that, you now go back to the definition, 18 U.S.C. 2331, go look at domestic terrorism, and you look at those I, triple I, you look at the context, and you tell me whether or not what the military did during the great Comey swindle doesn't fit. And this is another coverted truth hidden, a bigger truth of the ongoing deception to continue strife, which could undermine law enforcement's ability to counter white supremacists and anti-government extremists. Why isn't Patel clarifying all that for us if he means justice and not just us, the occupiers? We're seeing shifts moving on, but they're not changing the direction. They're not actually adjusting anything away from where they were going before. The noose is tightening all incrementally, all the time. It doesn't matter who's in charge. In the open-air prison of money laundering domestic terrorists that the United States is, we can see, for those of you listening very carefully here, map shows zip codes where $200 transactions could trigger federal reporting, talking about incrementally tightening the noose on the fiat system that you use, that they continue to make it so that there's less and less that will cause their scrutiny. What did I just say earlier? That they're going to make less and less of an action be it considered terrorism. We're watching right here around this immigration thing. People living in 30 zip codes along the United States-Mexico border are set to face a new level of scrutiny when they send money overseas or exchange currency in a government effort to counter money laundering by cartels. What have I said before about your presumption of innocence in all this? No, we're just all a bunch of cartel people that just haven't been caught yet. Federal authorities could now be flagged when someone tries to convert $200 or more rather than the standard $10,000 following an announcement by the United States Department of Treasury Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, or FinCEN. Quote, a big concern here is that the vast majority of people who are going to get caught up in their surveillance or conducting perfectly innocent transactions, and I can say that because that is what we see across the country, Nicholas Anthony, policy analyst at the libertarian-leaning Cato Institute, told Newsweek Tuesday, quote, it's not going to be catching the actual stated target, whether that be the cartels, drug runners, or other criminals. Maybe it'll only be okay to donate a coffee to RLM without scrutiny in the near future, what do you think? So find the donate buttons and donate today before you can't. Thank you for doing so to keep the message going out and the recent donations we just got. Thank you very much. It's all going in quickly to continue the growth of this network and to make it more secure and all, and looking for new ways to get the word out. We're Sound Mind's been doing a lot of work to get the broadcast spread to new accounts. And I can't remember now that all the numbers, but we're back into tens of thousands, moving through the weeks and then into, you know, hundreds of thousands here by the end of the month. So thank you for helping us do that. Again, the donation doesn't have to be just a coffee or whatever you can do now. You can all think about becoming a host, a broadcaster. Bring your content. So with all the acceptance that everything is a domestic terrorism, though it's not, but Trump, it's a shoo-in to get people to help put the shackles on a bit more and a bit more tighter as we read a new order that came out, a fact sheet, as a matter of fact. President Donald J. Trump protects the integrity of American elections. Now, I've talked about these elections for a long time here and there, and I'm not going to repeat all that again. So I hope you find those broadcasts and listen. Just the fact is, you can do your own research and find out for yourself what it's all about. You got to look behind the scenes, and not that you fill out a form. It's that what that form's coming from, the jurisdiction, the scope of it, why you even have to, and all of that kind of stuff. But here, federal election-related funds will be conditioned on states complying with the integrity measures set forth by federal law, including the requirement that states use the National Mail Voter Registration Form that will now require proof of citizenship. You know about Title VIII? Have you read, anybody listening, read Title VIII? The immigration laws are, and the nationalism and all that stuff, naturalization. You read any of that? Proof of citizenship. Safeguarding the vote. President Trump recognizes the free, fair, and honest elections unmarred by fraud, errors, or suspicion are essential to our constitutional republic. The United States lags behind all other nations in enforcing basic and necessary election protections. India and Brazil tie voter identification to a biometric database, while the United States largely relies on self-attestation for citizenship. You see how he's changing your presumption of innocence, and your voice, your statement is the truth? He wants to be, there are elections that are unmarred by fraud. Do you know that your driver's license or what you'll use as proving your citizenship is marred by fraud? It's a fraudulent and induced identity as well. Does anybody understand this? And then this is the fact sheet from this order that he just signed. Using India and Brazil for our basis? That means BRICS, right? President Trump? That's our example from you? Making elections secure again. Voters deserve elections they can trust. And that confidence is being restored thanks to President Trump. Let me interject on that. There's nothing President Trump can restore my faith in elections. Nothing. How far back does that go? 1993. I'll tell you all about it. That's when I first figured out the elections were rigged. Because I was at a machine that I could figure out that's how they rigged them. This is before they found out there was software that could do it. They were actually programming the chip. Remember, I talked about the EEPROMs. Why else would you have an EEPROM with it's a little window with an ultraviolet light over the top to neutralize it and reprogram it? Why else would it have a connector that went to the phone lines? And yes, it was baud rate speed, too, at that time. Nothing like we have today. Anyway, there's nothing that this guy can do to restore my faith in elections. President Trump is following through on his promise to secure our elections. President Trump, what's he going to secure actually? The elections or you? President Trump, quote, "We're going to fix our elections so that our elections are going to be honorable and honest, and people leave and they know their vote is counted. We are going to have a fair, free and fair elections. And ideally, we go to paper ballots, same-day voting, proof of citizenship, very big, and voter ID, very simple." President Trump, quote, "We will secure our elections, and they will be secure once and for all." So you see how all of MAGA fell for the real ID scam? federal voting is a facility requiring real ID, right? Go read what that's about. And the right to travel does not exist in the United States of America unless you have your papers, your authorized commercial entity papers. And the pressure promo is on from Homeland Security, not your security. And they write, you're not real ID ready. Important. If you want to board domestic flights or visit federal facilities beginning May 7th, 2025, you must have a real ID or any acceptable form of identification. And I want you to remember that little part and go look and see what is acceptable and make it so for you. There's an alternative, but for the most part, everyone's going to fight you unless you have that real ID, which will soon to be, if it's not already, soon to be digitized and moved into biometrics. Click on your state or territory in the map below and visit your local DMV to learn more. No, you might not need a real ID. So all these little stipulations you got to keep up with. Now just go to the DHS website where I got that statement. However, you'll notice they went to the state. Your state DMV is not federal. So what's the state DMV but federal? And what's that status that you're agreeing to? I've talked all about this in the past. So your states have sold out. So maybe it's time to be stateless, being without a home. Not homeless, being without a home. Remember tax home? Being without a home. Real ID FAQs. Federal agencies, including DHS and TSA, may only accept state-issued driver's licenses. And I need to interject there because I didn't catch this the first time I read it through. This is possessive driver's license. There's no such thing as a possessive driver's license. That license is the government's. Drivers does not have a comma F between R and S. Driver's license. Okay, so this is the one thing that they're misdirecting us here. But anyway, I didn't catch that till just now. It's very important to realize these things. State-issued driver's licenses and identification cards as identification for purposes of accessing federal facilities, including TSA airport security checkpoints, if the license or card was issued by a real ID compliant state in the accordance with the real ID security standards, meaning the license or card must include the real ID. So you think that Trump just required voters will have to be real ID compliant? That's not very American first. It's commerce control first. Again, Congress has the exclusive authority to regulate commerce amongst the states. Or don't you know that that's what the State Department of Motor Vehicles is about? Enforcing the privileged use of doing business on the highway as opposed to protecting the right of ingress and egress, which the state is supposed to do pursuant to its Enabling Act. For you, not from you. Well, which is, if it doesn't do, it's because you all as an occupied people. Why you need to have your traveling papers? Why else would you need a passport to travel within the United States as an alternative ID? Can you smell the digitization right around the corner on this? So let us go look at India. I've already talked about this problem. Trump is reducing the republic to and for his techno-swamp creatures. And I've talked about all this from India as well. How did I know this, folks? How did I know to keep pulling these things together today? It's together again, naturally. The future that they want, and Trump is giving them this when referencing this India in his voter ID requirement. What he talked about, where this goes. India's Election Commission advances voter digital ID linking initiative. Aadhaar's expanding grip on voter verification is reshaping India's electoral landscape, one biometric scan at a time. Remember again, it's incremental. The nose of the camel at the tent in the opening, that's all. This is where it goes, and this is what it started. This is what Trump is doing, referencing this right here. India's Election Commission is pushing an initiative aimed at linking voter ID cards, EPICs, electoral photo identity cards, with the country's digital biometric ID system. The system, Aadhaar, in turn links residents' fingerprints and iris scans to a unique 12-digit ID number. A meeting has been scheduled for this week that has been expected to discuss how to speed up the process and deal with any road bumps along the way. For now, the plan is to process of linking the EPICs with the Aadhaar to remain voluntary, and this is a thanks to a Supreme Court ruling. And the justification for this initiative of the linking of EPICs with Aadhaar is that it will improve election integrity, specifically around voter rolls. And I'm going to interject a little bit. Add now what Must Brad is doing with getting access to Social Security and all of those records. Again, without due process, and a judge came back and said, no, you're not supposed to go that far. Hold on. But look how fast they're running with getting all the information now. It's been, I don't know how they're going to protect how it didn't get confiscated by a private company right now, that they could do this already behind everybody's back. On this article, another recent development aimed toward the same goal is the announced launch in 2025 of the updated central KYC, Know Your Customer Registry, CKYCR. Before this, the country's postal service incorporated eKYC based on Aadhaar for savings accounts. Do you feel the noose tightening, folks, yet? Do you hear what I've been saying? And Trump just referenced that system in India for your system in America to make America great again. That's not anything America ever was, if I think about it. And to the techno-swamp future that they want, school uses AI to monitor kids hoping to prevent violence. The warm and fuzzy scapegoat here, the stalking horse they use, hoping to prevent violence from kids. Our investigation found security risks. The Education Reporting Collaborative. Hope people listen to me any length of time. I highlight these words. You know the system you're in when you see those words. It's already techno-bureaucratic. These are advisory issues, advisory councils, bureaucracies, but you don't have any property. They are the controllers, just in that one word. And the certain relationship is to a different authority. A coalition of 8 newsrooms is investigating the unintended consequences. Unintended? Of AI-powered surveillance at schools. The released documents show students use these laptops for more than just schoolwork. They are coping with angst in their personal lives. Students wrote about depression, heartbreak, suicide, addiction, bullying, and eating disorders. There are poems, college essays, and excerpts from role-playing sessions with AI chatbots. One student asked a search engine, quote, "Why does my boyfriend hit me?" Another threatened suicide in an email to an unrequited love. A gay teen opened up in an online diary about struggling with homophobic parents, writing that they just wanted to be themselves. In each case and thousands of others, surveillance software powered by artificial intelligence immediately alerted Vancouver Public Schools State of Washington State. Vancouver and many other districts around the country have turned to technology to promote school-issued devices 24/7 for any signs of danger as they grapple with the student mental health crisis and the threat of shootings. The goal is to keep children safe, but these tools raise serious questions about privacy and security, as proven when Seattle Times and Associated Press reporters inadvertently received access to almost 3,500 sensitive, unredacted student documents through a records request about the district surveillance technology. How many records did you get, Elon Musk, when you went into the Social Security files that are now converted to tax identification numbers? For those of you who haven't figured that one out either. Commerce, remember? You're a commerce entity. Vancouver school staff and anyone else with links to the files could read everything. Firewalls or passwords didn't protect the documents, and the students' names were not redacted, with cybersecurity experts warned was a massive security risk. The monitoring tools often helped counselors reach out to students who might have otherwise struggled in silence, but the Vancouver case is a stark reminder of surveillance technology's unintended consequences in American schools. Can we just throw that to your phones, too? I mean, I don't see the distinction there. In some cases, the technology has outed LGBTQ plus children and eroded trust between students and school staff while failing to keep schools completely safe. Gaggle, how close to Google, right? Gaggle Safety Management, the company that developed the software that tracks Vancouver school students' online activity, believes not monitoring children is like letting them loose on a digital background playground without fences or recess monitors. CEO founder Jeff Patterson said, "Boy, what did we do when we were kids? We were thrown out when the sun came up and told not to come back until dark. We didn't have any safety monitors." At any rate, jeez, how coddled these kids are anyway. But it's not about that either. I'm not blaming the kids one little bit here. Roughly 1,500 school districts nationwide use Gaggle's software to track the online activity of approximately 6 million students. It's one of the many companies like Go Guardian and Securely that promise to keep kids safe through AI-assisted web surveillance. The technology has been in high demand since the pandemic, when nearly every child received a school-issued laptop or tablet. Let me interject. You see what they used that for. They were ready to go with this issue, this situation. That was also part of the plan. Not just to affiance you, but to get the tools into the hands of people that are going to be programmed as they go through into their future. According to the United States Senate investigation, over 7,000 schools and districts used Go Guardian surveillance products in 2021. Vancouver schools apologized for releasing the document. Still, this district emphasizes Gaggle is necessary to protect students' well-being. Quote, "I don't think we could ever put a price on protecting students," said Andy Meyer, principal of Vancouver's Skyview High School. "Anytime we learn of something like that, that we can intervene, we feel that that is very positive." Sounds like the FBI, right? Intervene just in time to pick up some dupe from hurting himself and blowing up some other people that they caused, that they set up. Fabricate this, it's up their decision to make that determination. And then we see all the pressure, the programming, the cognitive warfare on young people. What could go wrong, folks? Dacia Foster, a parent in the district, commended the efforts to keep students safe, but worries about privacy violations. Quote, "That's not good at all," Foster said, after learning the district inadvertently released the records. Quote, "But what are my options? What do I do? Pull my kids out of school?" Foster says she'd be upset if her daughter's private information was compromised. And that's what they count on. You're just going to be upset. And then they'll let it go on. What should I do, folks? Everyone has the answer. They just don't want to go ahead and pull that trigger. Oh, excuse me. I didn't mean it like that. I'm going to pull my kid out of school, maybe. Maybe it's time to start really thinking about that. At the same time, she said, "I would like to avoid a school shooting or suicide." And I think the record has shown that the gun-free zones everywhere are magnets to this type of thing. And I find it also, as I said, I find it interesting. We haven't, maybe I won't say it, but we haven't heard of silence in one of these areas here. I'll just leave it like that. How student surveillance works. Gaggle uses a machine learning algorithm to scan what the students search or write online via a school-issued laptop, a tablet, 24 hours a day, or whenever they log into their school account on a personal device. The algorithms detects potential indicators of problems like bullying, self-harm, suicide, or school violence, and then sends a screenshot to human reviewers. If Gaggle employees confirm the issue might be serious, the company alerts the school. In cases of imminent danger, Gaggle calls the school officials directly. In rare instances where no one answers, Gaggle may contact law enforcement for a welfare check. And what did I talk about? Third-party liability to whatever they consider. This is public-private partnershiping right here. This is fascism. If I needed to give it a name, Vancouver school counselor who requested anonymity out of fear of retaliation. This is so good for the kids, though, folks. This school counselor has fear of intimidation and retaliation. Isn't that amazing? Said that they received 3 or 4 students' Gaggle alerts per month. In about half the cases, the district contacts parents immediately. Half the cases, parents get contacted. Development psychology research shows it is vital for teens to have a private space online to explore their thoughts and seek support. Quote, the idea that kids are constantly under surveillance by adults, I think that would be make it hard to develop a private life, a space to make mistakes, a space to go through the hard feelings without adults jumping in, said Bordeaux, the AI ethics researcher. Gaggle's Patterson school-issued device are not the appropriate place for unlimited self-exploration. If the exploration takes a dark turn, such as making a threat, quote, the school's going to be held liable, he said. Oh, that's what it's about. Quote, if you're looking for an open, free expression, it really can't happen on the school system's computers. So the lady had the answer. You can't just pull my kids out of school. Maybe you got to think about that. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe they got our society so fractured, we don't understand that's where it was supposed to stay. Because women were given suffrage. How's that? No one looked into that. No one looked down the road. This is BTWRLM 621. So this is how fast Russia is rushing to the technocratic future that they want relative to what we're hearing in these last few tabs. All started from Trump's voter ID and referencing India, and I already talked about the Aadhaar system. And biomet, it's all there, folks. Russia's rushing into the technocratic future that they want. Notice already Russian citizens are captured. When I read this little bit here, now bring the intense track and trace scrutiny upon visitors is Russia's moving to. Again, it's about this immigration stuff. They use that. The people in a country don't feel that it's wrong to get a foreigner. And this is why I read the article from John Whitehead, because he hits that point, I think, very well. And he says, it's not about immigrants. This is about you. What you're going to deny in someone else, you're going to agree to deny in yourself. And this is happening in Russia, too. You think all this is separate. Now, this fascinates me to watch how the integration of all this. Notice there's no trust, there's no presumption of innocence or private independence. And it's indifferent to the needs of the... all this answers in deference to the needs of the government and any deviation from which will invoke a government inspection. So as we read, a Russian citizen without an ID won't even be allowed to a football match. But we have complete trust in migrants. They enter Russia with a simple passport, the results of 680,000 illegals who are unclear where they live and what they do. This problem will be solved by the new people project, Migrant ID. I told the Prime Minister, Mikhail Mishustin, about it in detail. We must know everything about a migrant before he enters Russia, what he can do, where he will work, and where he will live. If such an employee is needed, we create a digital file. All the data is there. Biometrics, qualifications, documents. If everything is in order, he enters Russia, officially rents a place to live, and gets a job. Every step is visible. Stop paying rent, a reason for inspection. If it doesn't work, it's a reason for a deportation. There are development companies that can make a technical solution for migrant ID. People are waiting for it because it's a security issue. Full control is only an intermediate step. The main goal is to make our economy independent, not only from Western companies, but also from foreign workers. Solutions are already appearing in Russia. For example, robots for warehouse logistics are being made in St. Petersburg. They can sort, pack, and even deliver goods no worse than migrants. How to implement such solutions faster was discussed separately. It's coming to make a mental institution great again, folks. In America near you. I really can't believe what Trump referenced India. Well, we already know, behind which head, we've already discussed what India is doing. And it's what Russia is doing. How is that making America great again, to do what those countries are doing? And then in anticipation of the sustainable digital gulag and the future that they want, and just as we've been told, it's the global economy, stupid, but this is a Russian puff piece that we must read through to see the future intention. Just remember the parity which Russia needs to rise to in all of this talk of economic independence. There is no independence from the existing global financial system. And I've talked about all of that. And I'll leave it here for my listener to read about how independent Russia's economy is becoming, yet still interested in the global cross-border payment system that's already in existence, but which is being obsoleted for a sustainable digital gulag through system modernization that Trump is aiding and accelerating at home. In your homeland, your tax homeland, which is promoted and promoting the tech swamp creatures and their Stargate here. Does that ring a bell? Remember? So listen for this, what they're doing in Russia, and it's a reflection of what's going on in here. When people don't recognize what voter ID is about. It's tied to something else. Well, we got to vote, vote, vote. Well, we better look at that too. But SWIFT is a system of the past that will be replaced by the end of the decade. U.S. is ready to consider Russia's return to the international banking system, the SWIFT. Why is it interested in Russia's comeback? The interest is understandable. SWIFT is a logical and absolutely familiar for Americans. Nikita Molesnikov, an economist and expert at the Center of Political Technologies, tells Sputnik, quote, "Currently, the issues of international digital settlements are being tested. They are already in active use of digital financial assets and international payments for a number of countries and transactions. SWIFT is a system of the past," Melennikov adds, saying that by the end of the decade, alternative systems will emerge. Over 90 countries are presently testing their own central bank digital currencies. Are you following how they're doing this, folks? I told you this was coming. The sustainability is moving right along, but it's all about this financial system, this existing global system. Nobody is independent of that. This thing we hear about the chosen bankers is all part of that. It's all going there. Dmitry Trenin, liberalism is dead. This is what comes after. The phrase changing world order has become a familiar refrain in international affairs, but what's often missed is how rapidly the change is now unfolding and who is accelerating it. The fall of unipolarity, once long predicted and cautiously awaited, has arrived ahead of schedule. The United States, long the enforcer of liberal internationalism, is no longer trying to stop the shift towards multipolar. Under Trump, it has joined it. This is a departure from the binary moral framework of the past, and ironically, it aligns more closely with Moscow's own worldview. Under Trump, the White House no longer seeks to export liberalism, but to negotiate power. The world majority isn't a formal alliance, but a shared posture. Sovereignty over submission, trade over ideology, multipolarity over hegemony. Hegemony? Let me remind you, this is not true either. You're having to agree to submission and foregoing your sovereignty, as I've explained before, when you allow the global financial system to be your finances, be your monetary system, to be how you do business. BRICS, the SCO, remember, I is India in the BRICS, India, and Trump just relayed that they have a more advanced system, and the only advanced system that comes up is the one that's being integrated through their digital Siberian gulag. BRICS, the SCO, and other regional formats are maturing into genuine alternatives to the Western-led institutions. The Global South is no longer a periphery. It's a stage. Another kabuki. There is no point waiting for the new world to be declared. It's already here. We have moved beyond theory. Now begins the contest for position. The world has become multipolar, not because anyone willed it, but because power itself has shifted. Trump did not cause this alone, but he has perhaps unwittingly accelerated the process. So what have I explained about national parity for the assimilation into this existing global financial system that we have, that's existent? And when you replace those nations with that system, they are working toward, then you'll better understand what the process Trump is accelerating and for whom. And to put a finer point on that point, U.S. looking for a proper way to reconnect Russia to SWIFT, Treasury Secretary. Moscow has asked Washington to ease its sanctions as a step towards settling the Ukraine conflict. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has confirmed that all options remain on the table as Washington considers lifting certain sanctions against Moscow, including the possible reconnections of Russian banks, to the Belgian-based SWIFT. The U.S. and EU cut off major Russian banks from the SWIFT messaging system as part of a decade-long sanctions campaign, which has significantly expanded following the escalation of the Ukraine conflict in 2022. Quote, there would be a long discussion about many things in terms of the proper way to bring Russia back into the international system, Bessent told Fox News on Wednesday, emphasizing that it was, quote, premature to discuss the terms of a deal before we have a deal. And so just as I mentioned to you, it's not really going away. They're consolidating. Eventually, it's all coming back once they bring all these disparate economies more closer together, bring parity, adjusted parity to them so they can all be handled together. And what do we talk about? The AI looking at your kids and surveilling your thing. And I've talked about AI error prone. And the future, the Siberian future they want, and the Stargate all being triggered by AI. AI search engines fail accuracy test, study finds, 60% error rate. Bump that up to 96% if it's Grok 3. So if you don't believe the guy behind the woodshed, here's the study now. In context, it is a foregone conclusion that AI models can lack accuracy. Hallucinations and doubling down on wrong information have been an ongoing struggle for developers. Usage varies so much in individual cases that it's hard to nail down quantifiable percentages related to AI accuracy. A research team claims it now has those numbers. People I've been talking to, and myself, as I explained how you try to nail down this AI, give you responses responsive, it can be a challenge, and a hair-pulling situation may go on for a while. They really don't it work. I mean, it really is a choice of whether or not you want to waste your time with them. Sometimes they'll work, sometimes they won't. A lot of times they don't. They may give you a lead. But anyway, here's the numbers and maybe why even Grok 3 now, the media that is you, the website X is there artificial intelligence. Just ask Grok. Is 96% not correct? Come on. The Tao Center of Digital Journalism recently studied 8 AI search engines, including ChatGPT Search, the Perplexity Pro, Gemini, DeepSeek Search, Grok 2 Search, Grok 3 Search, and Copilot. They tested each for accuracy and recorded how frequently the tools refused to answer. The researchers randomly chose 200 news articles from 20 news publishers, 10 each. They ensured each story returned within the top 3 results in the Google search when using a quoted excerpt from the article. Let me interject there. There's your human knowledge, whatever Google says, and it's Google search. The article goes on. Then they performed the same query within each AI search tool and graded accuracy based on whether the search correctly cited A, the article, B, the news organization, and C, the URL. They didn't even check the content, I suppose. The article? What does that mean? That it existed? What it meant? The researchers then labeled each search based on degrees of accuracy from completely correct to completely incorrect. As you can see from the diagram below when you get the link, other than both versions of Perplexity, the AIs did not perform well. Collectively, AI search engines are inaccurate 60% of the time. Furthermore, these wrong results were reinforced by the AI's confidence in them. And as I think that, I read, man, what are those kids in the surveillance in those Vancouver schools? And then the AI that's looking at that hallucinates and decides that they're going to be swatted by the AI. Wow. The study is fascinating because it quantifiably confirms what we have known for years, that LLMs are the slickest con artists of all time. P.T. Barnabas. They report with complete authority that what they say is true even when it's not, sometimes to the point of argument or making up other false assertions when confronted. Even when admitting it was wrong, ChatGPT would follow up with admission with more fabricated information. The LLM is seemingly programmed to answer every user's input at all costs. The researcher's data confirms this hypothesis, noting that ChatGPT search was the only AI tool that answered all 200 article queries. However, it only achieved a 28% completely accurate rating and was completely inaccurate 57% of the time. ChatGPT isn't even the worst of the bunch. Both versions of X's Grok AI performed poorly, with Grok 3 search being 94% inaccurate. Microsoft's Copilot was not that much better when you consider that it declined to answer 104 queries out of 200. Of the remaining 96, only 16 were completely correct, 14 were partially correct, and 66 were completely incorrect, making it roughly 70% inaccurate. Arguably, the craziest thing about this is that the companies making these tools are not transparent about this lack of accuracy while charging the public $20 to $200 per month to access their latest AI models. Moreover, Perplexity Pro, $20 a month, and Grok 3 Search at $40 a month. Go PT! Answered slightly more queries correctly than their fee-free versions. Perplexity and Grok 2 Search, but had significantly higher error rates above. Talk about a con. However, not everyone agrees. TechRadar's Lance, of course not, folks. You're always going to be someone who wants to grab it. Says that he might never use Google again after trying ChatGPT Search. He describes the tool as a fast, aware, and accurate with a clean, ad-free interface. Feel free to read all the details of the Tao Center's public paper published in the Columbia Journalism Review, and let us know what you think, as the article asks. And I'd they never got to go back to Google, but it looks like they all went to Google to get their answers on this one. So I don't know how you avoid the Be Evil company. But with all this digitization and all this error prone digitization to cyber gulag, the reality comes from, despite the utopia, back to cash. Life without money in your pocket is not the utopia Sweden hoped. Nordic countries were early adopters. I'm bringing this up. Why? Because I was just talking about the global financial system is moving to digitization. All the countries are moving there, and Trump's moving us into Real ID, which is going to be the Aadhaar system, which is your sesame that China had, and your digital gulag, your Siberian gulag there, and your biometrics and all. So it's not not unconnected. Here, Sweden's been going through it, trying to move fast and furious. They had a lot of their people getting bugs in their hand, the little devices. They could just read your hand and off you went. But anyway, the truth is starting to come out. Nordic countries were early adopters of digital payments. Now, electronic banking is seen as a potential threat to national security. Well, let's add that into voter ID going into what an acceptable ID would be, and what's real ID going to have to happen if you get into a government facility, which is what the federal voting is about as well. And then that's going to be put into a digital database that Aadhaar in India has been doing, as an example. And Trump is saying this is all for national security. We get to hear, we're finding out it's a threat to national security. Is the problem with these ideas? The article goes on, in 2018, a former deputy governor of Sweden's central bank predicted that by 2025, the country would probably be cashless. 7 years on, the prediction has turned out to be pretty much true. Just in 1 in 10 purchases are made with cash, and card is the most common form of payment, followed by the Swedish mobile payment system, Swish. Launched by 6 banks in 2012 and now ubiquitous. Other mobile phone payment services are also growing quickly. But in the context of today, with war in Europe, unpredictability in the U.S., and the fear of Russian hybrid attacks almost a part of daily life in Sweden, life without cash has not proven the utopia that perhaps it once promised to be. Such is the perceived severity of the situation that the authorities are trying to encourage citizens to keep the use of cash in the name of civil defense. In November, the defense ministry sent every home a brochure entitled, If Crisis or War Comes, advising people to use cash regularly and keep a minimum of week supply in various denominations to strengthen preparedness. Let me interject in this back two paragraphs. It doesn't work now until everybody can't do anything else. And this is why you want to start doing everything else. They don't get through all. Once all the nations are involved, it's going digital. There's no need. Because they're going to say that's peace. You'll watch how they bring this all. The technocrats. This is how peace was going to be brought. And once they keep teaching your kids with their surveillance, they're going to believe it. But back to this article. In its report, the central bank says measures need to be taken to strengthen preparedness and reduce exclusions so that everyone can pay, even in the event of crisis or war. But not just war now, crisis too, see? So problems could happen. Forget this warmongering. You just could have a problem. For years, it says, efficiency has been a priority for payments, but now safety and accessibility are at least as important. Accessibility, folks. Your power goes out. Your phone dies. The systems, someone attacks your internet. Yeah, not such a good deal. No deal at all. Sweden is not the only Nordic country backpedaling on plans for a cashless society. Last year, Norway, which has a popular equivalent to Swish called Vips Mobile Pay, brought in legislation that means retailers can be fined or sanctioned if they will not accept cash. The government also recommended that citizens keep some cash on hand due to vulnerabilities in digital payment solutions due to cyber attacks. Norway's former justice and an emergencies minister, Emil Mell, put in it clear terms, quote, "If no one pays with cash and no one accepts cash, cash will no longer be a real emergency solution once the crisis is upon us. Ultimately, when it comes to emergency planning, the world's two most cashless societies are still banking on cash." And I would say adapt that view and start moving into silver and gold coin and start using that yourself, just like this. For as little as it is in Sweden, it's still something of value. Even the fiat they have, how much more so would be the silver and gold coin? And there's a whole lot of vulnerabilities built into a fiat system as we're watching. And the metal money, the real sound money, if you will, is going to be able to at least stabilize that for people. Now, one thing that Sweden wasn't quick to be an adopter of was the great Covey swindle jet. And maybe that's why they're coming out right now, and they're seeing what utopia doesn't provide. How's that? And from here again, the Midwest Doctor, another article, we have a report of a years-long research that he joined with Dr. Pierre Corey on jab shedding, of which I'm only going to read the summary. They did a ton of work, so it's something that you need. I mean, I think you need to go through. I think I'll just touch it for you. I'll just let you know it's available. You can get the link with the titled here, "What We've Learned from a Year of Vaccine Shedding Data." Numerous data sources now corroborate that the COVID vaccine shed is a consistent and replicable manner. Story at a glance. This is really all I'm going to read just to introduce you to this. After the COVID-19 vaccines hit the market, stories began emerging of unvaccinated individuals becoming ill after being in proximity to recently vaccinated individuals. This confused many, as the mRNA technology in theory should not be able to shed. After seeing countless patients' cases, which can only be explained by COVID vaccine shedding, a year ago, I initiated multiple widely seen calls for individuals to share suspected shedding experiences. From those 1,500 reports, a clear and replicable patterns have emerged which collectively prove shedding, is in quotes, we're just calling it shedding, is a real and predictable phenomenon that can be explained by known mechanisms unique to mRNA technology. Likewise, after being blocked by publication for over a year, recently a scientific study corroborating the shedding phenomena was finally published. This article will map out everything that is known about shedding. For example, what are the common symptoms? How does it happen? Who does it affect? Does it occur through sexual contact? Can it cause severe issues like cancer, along with strategies for preventing it? Now, you've heard me talk about that shedding potential way early on, and it was indicated by the reports of some of the testing. So I've been keen to keep watching on this, and I'll let you get this link and research it, make it important to you. This is really a big threat. I've wondered about it. Now they're finding that it is a problem. Now you have to assess how much of a threat of what you might want to be able to do. But I sent an ex-Twitter to Dr. Corey, who did a post about this. That's how I found out about it. And I wrote him, I've been talking about shedding for early on. I've likened the exposure reaction to stories I've heard of beekeepers' wives in close proximity to bee suits, though they never were stung. And I thank you both for all the follow-up work. And I'll tell my listeners, Operation Hindsight 2020, that'll be the tag you can get through the ex-Twitter of all the things I've put. You'll find lots of other things for Hindsight 2020, but you'll find my stuff there with that tag all the way back for all these things. And what I suggested there, which I didn't say in the ex-post reply, was that method of transmission, that I likened it to those bees, to the venom, which I identified from the various jab symptoms to be actually from a poisonous caterpillar from South America, if you remember that broadcast. Again, all the symptoms. And that one story I told you about the girl that stepped on a nest of those caterpillars, and she had all the symptoms that anybody who ever got a jab got, all in 4 or 5 days, I think it was, before she died. But I can't do this article justice than to provide the link so that you can give it the comprehensive study or full consideration and attention here to consider these things for yourself. And maybe as I reverse engineered the CDC suggestions to the jab, that it was a good idea for us unjab to keep at least 6 feet away from the jab people was a good start. They were actually telling us what we needed to do by telling the people that were jabbed what they should be keeping us away. Because it was, they weren't going to agree that they were the problem. As I told you, the jab was the infectious agent. And so we're in the first studies. I appreciated all the work they did. Years were the time, folks. So someone's put in with medical experience here, too, as well. North Carolina justices decide family can sue over unwanted COVID-19 shots. I guess I need to say it. The Midwestern doctor uses the term COVID-19 vaccines. I suppose that's just the way, there are doctors that don't talk that way, but you know that I don't say that they're vaccines. They were, as a matter of law, they're bioweapons. As a matter of law, they weren't to be used as a treatment relative to what we read in the local communicable disease law. So that said, people who did get jabbed, those that are unjabbed, can apparently be affected. And I didn't go through to find out the real mechanism they've come up with. But I haven't heard a good answer besides something like the exposure that you get through venoms that are literally in the air. They're just aerosoled. And they're proteins. Those venoms are just proteins. So North Carolina justices have decided that the families can sue of unwanted COVID-19 shots. The North Carolina mother and son can sue a public school system and doctors group on allegations that they have gave the boy a COVID-19 vaccine without consent. The state Supreme Court ruled on Friday, reversing a lower court decision that declared a federal health emergency law blocked the litigation. A trial judge and later the state court of appeals had ruled against Emily Heppel and her son Tanner Smith, who at age 14 received the vaccinations in August 2021. Despite his protests at a testing and vaccination clinic at Guilford County High School, according to the family's lawsuit, Smith went to the clinic to be tested for COVID-19 after a cluster of cases occurred among his school's football team. He did not expect the clinic would be providing vaccines as well, according to the litigation. Smith told workers he didn't want a vaccination and he lacked a signed parental consent form to get one. When the clinic was unable to reach his mother, a worker instructed another to give it to him anyway, Papel and Smith alleged in their legal brief. Does that sound like the AI and gaggle? Well, we couldn't get a hold of anybody, so we just decided. The cops will be here any minute. Papel and Smith sued the Guilford County Board of Education and an organization of the physicians who helped to operate the school clinic, alleging claims of battery and that their constitutional rights were violated. A panel of the Intermediate Level Appeals Court last year ruled unanimously that the Federal Public Readiness and Emergency Preparedness Act shielded the school district and the Old North State Medical Society from liability. The law places broad protections and immunity on an array of individuals and organizations who perform countermeasures during a public health emergency. The COVID-19 emergency declaration of March 2020 activated the law's immunity provision, Friday's decision said. Think about this and the fraud that I was talking about at that time. This is how they did it. No one challenged it. Now it's presumptive correct that the state did what it was supposed to do. But here, Chief Justice Paul Newby, writing on Friday's prevailing opinion, so the federal law did not prevent the mother and son from suing on allegations that their rights of state constitution have been violated. In particular, he wrote, there is a right for a parent to control their child's upbringing and the right of a competent person to be to refuse forced non-mandatory medical treatment. Can I interject? It says that's what the communicable disease law provides for. If you just go down the list and do it that way, this would have never happened. The article goes on to explain the federal law's plain text led a majority of justices to conclude that the immunity only covers tort injuries, Newby wrote, which is when someone seeks damages for injuries caused by negligent or wrongful actions. Quote, because tort injuries are not constitutional violations, the PREP Act does not bar plaintiffs' constitutional claims, he added, while sending the case back, presumably, for a trial on the allegations. Associate Justice Allison Riggs, writing a dissenting opinion backed by the other Democratic justice on the court, said that the state constitutional claims should be preempted from the federal law. Riggs criticized the majority for fundamentally unsound constitutional analysis. Quote, through a series of dizzying inversions, it explicitly rewrites an unambiguous statute to exclude state constitutional claims from the broad and inclusive immunities, Riggs said. So we'll have to wait and see how this plays out a little bit. It did go to the state Supreme Court, but if there's going to go to the federal Supreme Court, I'm not sure. But here you see how they reanalyze this to say, well, this was not a tort violation. This is not a tort claim. This is a constitutional claim, and you have your constitutional rights. And then we have this idea, we hope, that the constitutional rights cannot be subverted by this essentially executive administrative function. And I hear nothing here that says that they even push that, right? So this is my main problem with all this is that there's no immunity when the government did not non-fraudulently demonstrate that infectious agent in the son or in the mother or anybody. And that's why the clinic didn't have the right to give them anything. They weren't the doctor. They weren't shown to be someone suspect. And if you go back through the local communicable disease law, you'll see the list of steps that has to be done before someone has to even make a decision, as you heard me explain over and over. So I won't continue to do that. But y'all won't have to wait for any future COVID care in Arkansas. Ivermectin becomes accessible without prescription in Arkansas under new state legislation. Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders has officially signed the Senate Bill 189. Into law, interesting number there too, very good, granting approval for the sale and purchase of ivermectin for human use without a prescription. The new legislation signed into law on Tuesday allows ivermectin suitable for human consumption to be sold over the counter in Arkansas, making it accessible to individuals without the need for a prescription or consultation with a healthcare professional. And this is probably the biggest deal. A lot of people who can't afford to go to a doctor or regular at all need to be able to access some of this medicine, so-called, whatever they want to call this stuff, without this overburden, $200 a visit or whatever it is that you don't have. But here we have Arkansas is going ahead and going to make ivermectin over-the-counter. Legislation explicitly states that ivermectin suitable for human use may be sold or purchased as an over-the-counter medication in this state without prescription or consultation with a healthcare professional. This development marks a notable shift in the state's stance on the drug, which has traditionally been available only through a doctor's prescription. Very, very interesting. It's very important for those of you that have been studying this ivermectin. I find this drug, this chemical, just fascinating on what it does. As well as I was reading on fenbendazole, it's similar. It has a very similar type of thing. Very interesting what's going on with this. It's hard to say it's not a miracle type of thing. And then we also know that it's relatively safe. It's not something you disregard. It is a drug, but fascinating. It's a fascinating compound at all. But if these were in place during the Great COVID swindle, the jabs could not have been authorized for use, being that there would have been a viable treatment. So never forget that the CDC and the FDA, what they did to help foist the military attack on we the people, which Trump started. Never forget the real ID of who the domestic terrorists are. That's right. Go back and apply the definitions of domestic terrorism to that. Won't you, please? Cat turd. Don't guess. Don't throw it out there. It's all black and white. Just start applying the black and white. Don't even have to question it. Go look at that definition. 18 U.S.C. 2331. Apply domestic terrorism, the statutes. Look at what the government military did, what Trump started, what the whole of every state government did, never fulfilling the law, what it did to people, and how it disrupted the economy and the population and killed people. And don't argue to me that the domestic terrorism wasn't caused by the government itself. Where's the accountability that John Whitehead is asking for, what I've asked for, what my listeners that I've communicated with asked for? Then other domestic terrorists for profit, safe and not persistent, on Satan said, Bayer ordered to cough up another $2 billion over Roundup. Remember all their claims, and then watch what happened out down the road. Look how long it's taken to start getting these verdicts out of the harm that was caused. A jury in Georgia has ordered Monsanto parent company to pay nearly $2.1 billion Bravo dollars in damages to a man who says that the company's Roundup weed killer caused his cancer, according to attorneys representing the plaintiff. The verdict marks the latest of a long-running series of court battles Monsanto has faced over its Roundup herbicide. The agrochemical giant says it will appeal the verdict reached in the Georgia courtroom late Friday in efforts to overturn the decision. The penalties awarded include $65 million in compensatory damages and $2 billion in punitive damages. Law firms Arnold Itkin LLP and Klein Inspector PC said in a statement that marks one of the largest legal settlements reached in a Roundup-related case to date. And I suspect most of that money is going to them. But anyway, plaintiff John Barnes filed a suit against Monsanto in 2021 seeking damages related to his non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Arnold and Itkin attorney Kyle Findley, the lead trial lawyer on the case, said that the verdict will help put his client in a better position to get the treatment he needs going forward. Boy, I would wonder whether or not that ivermectin might help with fenbendazole and some other one of those zoles. Very fascinating stuff and very interesting things, what it looks like cancer might be for those of you that haven't really studied it. So kind of bringing up some old studies for me that people were theorizing it. Cancer wasn't what we were told, like as usual. And it's something else. And that these drugs that are coming out are killing it, and no one wanted to say so. Like, we didn't want to say there was a suggested cure for the so-called COVID swindle, where they were going to want to jab, so they needed to shut up the thing that would do it, so they could get lots of money from the government and steal from people into high prices for scaring everybody about their cancer and giving them cancer. What do we hear? There's cancer here, but we heard what? There's another company, Johnson & Johnson, put materials, stuff inside their sunscreen. And noticed that someone did the analysis and noticed that their pharmaceutical side had medicines that treated the cancer that they found the contaminated product that they made on the sunscreen would fix. Oh, man. Just on and on what they got going for us. It's been a long road for him, and he was happy, I'm sure, that the truth related to the product has been exposed. And again, I have to say, they said they're going to appeal. We'll see how this all works out. But right now, it's not looking good for Monsanto's product, or Bayer. Bayer, folks. He called the verdict an important milestone after another example of Monsanto's refusal to accept the responsibility for poisoning people with its toxic product. And that really is the big problem. They lied about its persistence in the environment. They lied about its effects. They covered it all up. If I understand the evidence of other cases correctly, it's absolutely a big cover-up. Like, we've even seen in movies, I couldn't tell them the titles to you, but like we've seen in other movies where they found out that there was big corporate lobbying and they understood what the problems were, and that was what the big cover-up. German-based Bayer which acquired Monsanto in 2018, has continued to dispute claims that Roundup causes cancer, but the company has been hit with more than 177,000 lawsuits involving the weed killer and set aside $16 billion to settle cases. In a statement, Monsanto said Friday, verdict, quote, conflicts with the overwhelming weight of scientific evidence and the consensus of regulatory bodies and their scientific assessments worldwide. Findlay accused Monsanto of ignoring several scientific studies related to the toxicity of Roundup. We get back to the consensus of regulatory bodies. It was the FDA and the CDC and the Great COVID Center, wasn't it? The WHO. Not the Rock Raptor Owl, but the World Health Organization, wasn't it? Not even the little people from WHO yet. Some studies associate Roundup key ingredient, glyphosate, with cancer, although maybe we're going to go search those little people from Whoville with them being sprayed with Roundup. Maybe, I wonder what kind of cancer they got. Well, with cancer, although the Environmental Protection Agency has said it is not likely to be carcinogenic to humans when used as directed. This was another lie, because as directed, it's still persistent in the environment. And this comes 2 months after a $2.25 billion verdict on another case. So how to stop these brokers of HARMA? And I've reported on this authority, a tug of war, where the WHO attempts, now this, again, the World Health Organization, not the Rock Group, the OWL, or the little people from Whoville, the WHO attempts to throw shade on the local government authority and diagnostic capabilities to gain some deciding authority, which it can leverage against the government to push the international agenda, the HARMA brokerage agenda. Let me read this next report sort of inside out to prove a point relative to this article. 900 infected and 52 killed in Equator province last month. Scientists learn cause of killer outbreak in Congo. Last month, doctors ruled out known viruses such as Ebola, Marburg, yellow fever, and dengue after testing more than a dozen samples. The WHO said additional tests were being conducted to determine if other diseases, including typhoid fever, meningitis, and viral hemorrhagic fevers, could also be responsible. So there, which disease is missing? The answer is in the absence, just like in reading the JFK files, which I'll probably put a link in for those files. I won't talk about it. I was going to do it last week. Had the tech diff, so I couldn't get to it. But probably not going to talk too much about those, but I'll give you the link to those. And so you have to have a sense of history, and you have to have a sense of the time and place on this article here, and the sense of how to apply or reject these facts to come to an answer. And you start to read the JFK files that way as well. A lot of these things. What didn't they test for in that list that they just mentioned? But they did test for it early on, and nothing turned up, which is another interesting thing. Now, I can believe the government strategy would be to rule out the most dangerous first, what was at the time an unknown, for whatever reason. Once we find out what this concerning outbreak is caused by, there's a potential reason why they didn't go there, But anyway, because of, again, this bad promotion that's out there, you start fearing all kinds of stuff. So you start looking at all kinds of stuff, but it's wasting a lot of time. But why would the WHO insist in tests that are not of something more prevalent than the territory is known for? That's the thing you've got to ask here. From the WHO data, you'll see in the report that 93% of these deaths occur in Africa. Well, what deaths? So the WHO here shows it is a deceiver having ulterior motives when it knows what the 93% of the deaths is caused by, but it's not mentioning it. This shows you it needs to keep its nose out of local affairs. And if it had any authority, it would have and accepted it would have been there to cause delay, if not an improper treatment, as we saw with the Great COVID swing. Or worse, a fabricated treatment, like we saw with the Great COVID swindle, the novel Great COVID swindle, the fabricated test, the controls that they had on the testing, which was not a test. Can you hear the cha-ching going on with all this type of control? I knew you could. Why did the officials and the WHO, all the experts, look for, why did they look for everything but malaria when the territorial is known for malaria? That 93%? The large mosquito in the room, why are they looking for meningitis and viral spreaders with the limited number that were affected as well? Where did the WHO likely shoehorn its way into the Democratic Republic of Congo? Well, the DRC previously suffered a severe outbreak of Mpox virus, formerly known as the monkeypox, with over 2,000 new suspected cases weekly, according to the WHO, right, the WHO. So another WHO scare tactic, injecting a novel lab-made up disease to scare up authoritative influence using gay lifestyle as a crowbar to jimmy the windows of reason. But instead, the government went back to the basics, and good for them, and for the people most of all. Lab testing on the samples has been confirmed that the illness was malaria, according to the professor Christian Ngandu of the INSP, who also heads Congo's Public Health Emergency Operations Center. It was simple malaria, folks. The WHO lambasted this government, demanding that it be involved in testing. The WHO was intending to look for everything other than malaria to find the culprit. The government declined the WHO, the offer, and the insult. Is why you need to make sure local protocols and due process are in place, protected, and dutifully implemented by the government officials. My rub with these court cases. None of that's even being exposed. And we found that in the Great Kobe Swindle. The locals were all too eager to abandon their post when bribed to do so. And we don't want that to have that happen to us again. But we do want to know the non-fraudulent cause, because not only is it the law, it could mean our very lives. And because scientists may learn, but you could be dead during their transition from ignorance. This is BTWRLM 621. I'll be with you next week. Tech Diffs, or Nature Willing.
Echoes call, the hour is near. Behind the woodshed, the truth you'll hear. Every Sunday, the clock strikes three. Hal's voice rolls like thunder, piercing free. Pull up a chair, lean in close, lessons to learn. Dose by dose, behind the woodshed, no stone unturned. Truth still reigns in Hal's words, freedom sings.
heed the call. Behind the woodshed standing tall.